This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Women in Sunlight by Frances Mays. Read for you by Kimberly Farr. For Rena Williams. Walk on air against your better judgment. Seamus Heaney, The Gravel Walks. Part 1. Arrivals. By chance, I witnessed the arrival of the three American women. I'd been reading in my garden for a couple of hours, taking a few notes and making black dots in the margins, a way to locate interesting sentences later without defacing the book. Around 4:30 on these early darkening days, some impulse toward dinner quickens, and I began to consider the veal chops in the fridge, and to think of cutting a bunch of the chard still rampaging through the orto. Chard with raisins, garlic, and orange peel. Thyme and parsley for the tiny potatoes Colin dug at the end of summer. Since the nights were turning chilly, I put down my book, grabbed the wood carrier from the house, and walked out to the shed to fetch olive tree prunings for the fireplace grill. Yet another escape. I am putting off writing about Margaret, my difficult and rigorous friend, whose writing I admired. Oh, still admire. But this project feels more like trying to strike mildewed matches. I keep rereading instead of writing. I've read her Stairs to Palazzo del Drago a dozen times. A book can be a portal. Each one I've written, firmly sealed off one nautiline chamber, is nautiline a word, meaning pertaining to a nautilus, and then opened into the next habitable space. Always before, my subjects chose me. I'm the happy follower of fleeting images that race ahead, sometimes just out of sight, of lines that U-turn and break like the downside of heartbeats. Isn't Boustrophedon the ongoing form of writing that mimics the turns an ox makes when plowing a field? At times, writing conflagrates, a vacant lot fire started by bad boys. That's when I'm elated. But this time, I chose my friend as the subject. I feel as I did in college, slugging out a research paper on the concept of time in T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. I enjoyed the work, but immediately felt humiliated by my limits. I'm easily distractible. Those shriveled apples on the third terrace, still golden and dangling as brightly as in the myth of the Three Graces, lure me to make a galette. Fitzy has burrs in his silky hair and needs brushing. My own hair has turned unruly. I would like to have a few friends over for polenta with mushrooms and sausage, now that the funghi porcini are sprouting under every oak tree. My mind surfs over endless diversions. When you're propelled by a sense of duty, you're easy to derail. As I picked dried branches from the woodpile, I looked down from the upper olive terrace as Gianni, the local driver, turned sharply into the long drive of the Malpiede place across the road, his white van crackling over dry stubble. Malpiede, bad feet. I've always loved the Italian names that remind me of ones my friends and I adopted when we played Wild Indians in the vacant lot by my family's house in Coral Gables. Wandering Bear, Deer Heart, Straight Arrow. One friend chose Flushing Toilet, but here it's Bucaletto, Hole in the Bed. Zappini, Little Hoe. Tagliaferro, Iron Cutter, and, stranger, Taglia la Gamba, he cuts the leg, Maybe a butcher specializing in leg of lamb? Cipollini, little onion. Taglia sopra, cut above. Bell'occhio, beautiful eye. How alive those names are. Early in my years in Italy, fascinated by every syllable, I used to collect them. In hotels, when there were telephone books, I'd read the names at night for the pleasure of coming upon Camino Merde, chimney shit, there's a story there, and pipi seca, dry pipe, or penis. The sublime Botticelli, little barrel. The bad feet are gone now. I attended the wake for Luisa, the wife, who had an erotically decorated cake at her last birthday. Figures like those feasting frescoes from Pompeii in the Naples Museum, where the phallus is so large it's carried forth on a tray. Passing by their table in the restaurant where she was celebrating with friends, I was shocked to look down at the garish pink and green cake everyone was laughing over. After that, I was embarrassed when I saw plump, stoop-shouldered, rabbit-eyed Tito, her husband. She died of diverticulitis, some sudden rupture I couldn't help but think was caused by too much cake, and Tito followed all too shortly. He did choke, but on pork arista, with no one around to perform the Heimlich. I try not to imagine his rheumy eyes popping out of their sockets. The daughter, Grazia, who snorts, then brays when she laughs, painted some rooms, put in a dishwasher, and listed the house for lease before she went to live with her failing aunt in town. I later learned that the rental terms included an option to buy after 1 year. Grazia was not coming back to rattle around in the big stone house that was cool in the summer and cool in the winter. I missed them as neighbors. I even missed the years of Grazia's squealing violin practice, Luisa's piano, and Tito's sax. Hours of sour notes wafting up the hill. We'd lived parallel lives on the same slope for 11 years. And then, within 6 months, the house stood empty, with the kitchen shutter banging in the night when the tramontana blew in from the Alps. I've always loved their house. Its big square self, rooted firmly on a long flat spur of our terraced hillside, and the great double portone with sphinx-faced door knockers, popular from the time Italy was ransacking Egypt. Over the door, the fanlight's fanciful iron curls, twisted around the letter S, the initial, I suppose, of the person who built such a solid structure 300 years ago. If you cut away the jasmine vines, you'd see viret in aeternum, it flourishes forever. A prideful motto. The house's name? Villa Assunta. Perhaps it was finished around the holiday Ferragosto, when the Virgin Mary assumed into heaven. 6 big square rooms up, 6 down. Afterthought bathrooms, but okay. I would sometimes take Tito and Luisa a basket of plums when my trees were dripping with them. As their door swung open, a splash of light pooled on the waxed bricks. At the end of the hall, I saw the great, large-paned window full of splayed green linden leaves, and in winter, angular black limbs like a dashed-off charcoal sketch. Down in the olive grove, I saw Gianni's van weave in and out of sight, through silvery trees, glimpses of white, scree of trees, flash of white. He descended the rough drive, pulling into the weedy parking spot beside the house, where Luisa often used to leave her blue Fiat 500 ragtop open to the rain. I always wanted to use that image in a poem, but it never fit. 3 women got out, Hardly the three graces as they dragged carry-on bags and clumsy backpacks and totes. Johnny hauled out four mastodon-sized suitcases and struggled each one to the door. I couldn't hear the women, who appeared to be exclaiming and laughing. I supposed they were here for an autumn vacation. There's a certain kind of traveler who shuns the hectic summer months and arrives for the season of more solitude. I hoped they would not be noisy. Sound travels in the hills. If their husbands are arriving and boozy dinners ensue, there could be chaos. Who are they? Not young. I could see that. My own arrival here, Dio, 12 years ago, seems as vivid as yesterday. I stepped out of the car, looked up at the abandoned stone farmhouse, and I knew. What did I know? This is it. This is where I invent the future. Could they be thinking the same? And Margaret, too, my subject, my lost friend, once arrived, long, long before me, at her golden stone house below the tower of Il Palazzone, big palazzo indeed, not knowing what life she might find. What she did find immediately was a huge, squealing pig left shut in the lower level by the farmers, former owners, peasants, she called them, as a gift. Margaret was a firm exile, not like me, a come-and-go one, and in her embroidered slippers and Venetian black Divore velvet coat, nothing like these latest arrivals in magenta, orange, saffron, puffy down jackets and boots. The one in the electric magenta hoists a dog carrier out of the van's rear door. She kneels and releases a small toffee-colored yapper that starts up right away, running in circles around all of them, almost lifting off the ground with joy. So I guessed, since they've brought a dog, they're not here for a brief holiday. Gathering more fire starter, I fell into sort of a reverie. Their gestures and movements below me seemed suddenly distant. A static tableau, some latter-day illustration for a medieval book of hours. Under a dapple gray sky, the stalwart house catching late rays, stones gleaming as if covered with snail tracks, the windows mottled glass bouncing back the sunlight as mirror. Between Villa Assunta and me, elongated shadows of cypress trees stripe the village road. As if behind veils, for the afternoon light here turns to a pale, honeyed transparency, the slow-motion women walk toward the door, where Gianni fumbles with the iron key that used to hang by a tattered orange ribbon on a hook inside the door. I knew they'd soon inhale the old book smell of the closed house. They'd step in and see that hall window, back-blazed with golden linden leaves, possibly would stop to take in a breath. Oh, so that's where we are. Why did tears sting my eyes? Oh, Louisa, you never did get that craggy mole taken off your chin. Never even plucked the coarse spike of hair that I weirdly had the impulse to touch. Too late. You are gone, what, a year? And Tito, too, with his huge phallus or not, his meek smile, and now almost totally erased are the many seasons in the great old cucina, with a fireplace big enough to pull up a chair, pour a smidgen of vin santo, and tell stories of the war, when many local men walked home barefoot from Russia. That flaky Grazia could have had the yard cleared up a bit. All gone. Gone with the Wind, the book I devoured in my early teens. Still a great title. Margaret also, Via col Vento. What a sharp writer, La Margarita. What glinting eyes. I used to study her clean, clipped prose style. I like to use and because for me, everything connects. She never used and because for her, nothing connected. In writing, you can't hide who you are. Over the years, her work simply evaporated from public view, even Sun Raining on Blue Flowers, which had impressive critical attention, and despite that, still managed to appear on bestseller lists. Most of my writer friends never have heard of her. I feel compelled to reawaken interest in her few books. Not that I have the power to secure her a place in the canon, if the canon even still exists. Arrivals. All potential. I remember mine. The Black Iron Key, the real estate agent Peshe Kane, yes, Dogfish, handed over after I signed the last paper. Me walking through the empty rooms, counting them. 11, most of them small. 4 below once housed farm animals and still had enormous smooth stone floors and a rime of fluffy white mold from uric acid. Upstairs, the ceiling soared because there had been attics, long since collapsed, for grain and chestnut storage. I'd forgotten the dank cantina tacked onto the long kitchen and dining room wing. I remember the creak of the latch. Then pushing open the shutters, the view pouring in like grace received. Casa Fonte de la Folie, Fountain of Leaves. Maybe that's why I fell for it, that poetic name scrawled on the oldest local maps. Apt for my leafy plot of olive, linden, ilex, and pine layered around a curve of hillside. I'd only seen the inside once and didn't even remember the two upstairs fireplaces or the sagging beam in the kitchen. Not mouse skeletons in the pantry. My house from the outset seemed mine. I literally rolled up my sleeves and set to work. What the three women are seeing now, will it imprint forever or will it slowly fade? Once the vacation ends. Like that house I rented one July in the Mugello, north of Florence, the vintage fridge formed such an igloo that the door wouldn't close. If you touched the handle, you got an icy shock. I can't picture the bedrooms at all, but I remember decades-old Christmas cards and christening invitations in the sideboard drawer. Memory has shut the doors all the way down a long hall. Only one stands open at the end, an empty white room with white pigeon dung in a line on the floor under a rafter. Who snatches up their roots and roosts in a foreign country where they have no people? I did. Margaret, well, she was born to roam. Now you can never go home, she used to threaten. But you can go home. It's not drastic. That is, until you're not sure where home is. How many hopefuls have I seen arrive and begin life here, only to wake up one day, after the restoration, after the Italian class? I thought Italian was supposed to be easy. After the well gone dry, after the boozy lunch after lunch with others who speak little Italian, after stone cold winter, and think, what in hell am I doing here? Even so, powerful propulsions drive us. Drove Margaret, drove me. In the Florence train station, arrival signs flash right next to the enticing departures. Treni in arrivi, treni in partenze, one suggesting the other. I still want to board every one. Margaret abandoned her Casa Gelsomino, Jasmine House. Long her destiny. Then not. 2 summers she returned, staying with us. By that time she was critical of Italy, and one night when her patience snapped, she said to me, "You're like a child, naïf, perpetually astonished." I said nothing. She'd ripped into me once before. Colin chided her. "Oh, Margaret, you know that's bullshit. Kit sees all." And he poured her a shot of grappa to end the evening. "Italy's an old country. That, at least, you know. Babies are born old here. That you don't know." She threw back the grappa in a gulp, looked wide-eyed for a moment, and said, "Buonanotte." And these three, just choosing their bedrooms and flinging their luggage on the bed, just noticing that these Tuscan manses have no closets, just a cavernous, creaky armadio in each room. What brings them to Luisa's stern villa? Is the end of their story already embedded in the beginning? Eliot's "In the Beginning Is My End" exasperated me as a college junior. How dreary, I thought then. But now, I do wonder. When and how will my time here come to an end? Fate, too propitious a word. But what red thread connects an unforeseeable end to the day I arrived in a white sundress, opened the door, threw up my arms, twirled around, to the surprise of the agent, and shouted, "I'm home!" Walking to the house, basket of sticks in hand, last rays of sun exploding in molten splotches on the lakes out in the valley, an armful of charred, sprigs of thyme and rosemary in my pocket, Colin waving from the front door, Fitzy springing up after a copper leaf spiraling toward the grass, stairs to Palazzo del Drago left on a lawn chair, Gianni beeping, mouthing, "Buonasera, signora," as his van freed of passengers speeds by, a little music, Thelonious Monk drifting from my house. There, like that, the subject chose me. Crazy Salad. Colin's veal chops, a fire, a most excellent Brunello from our stash, and an unexpected rain pelting the black windows. What could be better? Of the great experiences of my life, there are many. But nothing exceeds the plain happiness of a fall night at home. Bach cello concerto on low. A couple of handfuls of chestnuts to roast over the coals. It's beyond luck that I sit here listening to Colin compare versions of Mozart operas he loves, talk about Walter Benjamin's Arcades Project, the messiest book ever written, and about how his corduroy pants pocket has ripped. Plus, he keeps our glasses filled halfway, toasts various absent friends, and leaning in to poke the fire, looks warmed and handsome in the leaping light. As I swirl my glass, the flames bounce glowing crescents onto the wall. Broken moons, transparent and colliding. How shall I proceed? What can I observe that prefigures the fate awaiting me, awaiting these three women who might have now discovered Tito's spider-haunted wine cellar and are opening some dusty, sure to be sour, Vino Nobile di Montepulciano. Sharply kept in my mind's eye, the ritual ancient Egyptians practiced. On the day of a pharaoh's birth, slaves began to build his tomb. When my notebook with good paper ends, when my computer files are jammed with notes and lists of words and questions, will these new arrivals on the hill be gone? Will Margaret be laid to rest at last? Will I leave or stay? I think I am a reliable narrator, but I'm not sure. I'm the sort of writer who likes to have two projects going at once, or three. My poetry is sporadic. I don't force it. On that, I'm with Keats, who thought poems must come to you as naturally as leaves on a tree. More mundanely, writing for me is like cooking. I like to have all the burners blazing when I'm in the kitchen. Though this sounds as though I'm a house afire as a writer, I've written only three books of poetry and two short prose works. The first of those was on Freya Stark, who set off in the 1920s for Arabia and Assyria, where no other Western woman had traveled. She was a stellar writer. The second book, a short bio, focused on Maud Gonne. Yeats, my all-time favorite poet, loved her passionately and gave her face some immortal lines. Two of the oddest are food-oriented. Hollow of cheek as though it drank the wind and took a mess of shadows for its meat. In another poem, she favored a crazy salad with her meat. She was a crazy salad herself, once she had sex inside the tomb of her dead 2-year-old son. She hoped to capture his spirit for a new child. I almost can understand a grief like hers. Writing is a crazy salad, too. Crazy main course and dessert, as well. What gives me the confidence to begin a new book? Well, I won 2 major awards for my collection, Momentary Maps. George Clooney, riding through my adopted village of San Rocco on a motorcycle, stirred far more local interest than my faraway awards. Tuscans are not much impressed by celebrity of any kind, even Clooney, though the carabinieri in their Valentino uniforms did escort the mayor to my house to present me with a bouquet of lilies. I went to New York, Boston, D.C., the West Coast. How glorious to be lauded and toasted. But after that, nothing seemed to happen because of the 2 framed citations, except for a few offers for visiting lectureships at universities, and why would I want to do that? Winter in Ithaca, summer in Arizona. The 2 foundations gave me substantial cash, substantial for a poet, anyway, with which I gratefully replaced the septic and heating systems in my house. Poetry, they say, makes nothing happen. But truly, it makes everything happen. The electric line, the pith of the language, the nailed-it figurative image, that's my home, my first love, and the thing that people perish for the lack of in their lives. Someone else said that, but who? I was honored. Many poets labor forever in a vacuum. I wish I could believe the awards were deserved, but I deeply suspect that living in Italy, well away from the internecine literary wars, helped. Maybe I was the only one everyone could agree on. If you know of me at all, which I doubt, it's probably for Broken Borders, my Freya book. Through Margaret's connection with a producer, the unthinkable happened, and my concise tribute to a heroine of mine became a wide-release film. You've seen it. Sure you have, but who knows the name of a writer behind a movie? Chaste Freya would not have appreciated the screenwriter's edition of sex scenes with Assyrian desert warlords. I consoled myself with the fact that many new readers found their way to Freya's actual books. She, though dead, and Hollywood, and I made money. Again, not money like the digital whizzes or even like my cousin in real estate, but a benison for me. I finished the kitchen renovation. The rest I stashed away. My Maud book, too, gave me egress into larger worlds. She's simply called out to be written about, and I heard her. The playwright Orla Kilgren adapted my Swan of Cool for the stage, wonderfully interweaving Yeats's poems with my text. 5 years later, the curtain still rises 4 nights a week in Dublin. Colin and I make many friends through various productions and festivals, and God knows, enough of the actors and directors have found their ways to Tuscany for exhaustingly long visits. Sometime expat that I am, in love with Europe since my Florida childhood, I've never taken on an American subject. Certainly not five of them. The women, me, and Margaret, who's American only by birth, and from Washington, D.C. at that. I'll fly on cultural memory, instinct, wax wings if I have to. By chance. As Colin puts down the fire, I step outside to see the black woolly sky punctured with diamantine stars. In other places they shine, here they blaze. You have to gasp. Best to fall on your knees. Through the trees, the Malpiedi house looks like a gray square smudge against the darker hill. Is one of the women looking out the window, amazed at the fiery constellations? Tonight, 5 stars form a connect-the-dots waterfall, splashing onto a wedge of moon. Is another having her first dream in Italy? And the third, her little dog at her feet, perhaps sleeps the deep country sleep, darksome and silent, and will wake at 4 a.m., dazzled by the knowledge that she is waking up in Italy. Italy! Local artisans still make blank books with leather spines and pretty paper covers. Friends give them to me for birthdays. Visitors leave them with notes saying they hope I will be inspired. A writer must be in want of a blank book, right? In this lifetime, or the next, I won't be able to fill all the daunting white pages, especially since I usually work on a legal pad or computer. But tonight I take a special one off the shelf. A bone-colored vellum spine and abstracted yellow flowers bind a thick book that opens nicely. Will I find my way? A reviewer described my poetry as sparse and harsh. My prose, instead, luxuriates in detail, what I think of as illuminations. Why write prose unless you can go off on side trips, layer, and loop back to the subject at hand? Here, I'll hope to start at the beginning of an odyssey, 100 revelations and stories. The ending? As in the last line of a poem, a novel, even this hybrid, may find that its own end feels like a beginning. Or a spinning. A dime tossed off a high bridge. San Rocco lies just beyond 2 curves downhill. I zigzag over on a Roman road, and I'm at the town gate in 10 minutes. Doubtless, this is why the three women chose the Malpiedi place. I've seen the website. Easy walking distance to town jumps out as what everyone wants. An isolated house, but near the piazza. When I walk in tomorrow morning, as is my habit, most likely I'll hear of the three women's arrival. Probably an incident or two will have circulated via Gianni, the driver, and also Grazia's opinion, formed from maybe 3 emails, will be widely quoted. Before I go to bed, I draw an orange leaf on the first page and write, "New leaf." What follows will accumulate slowly. Their stories will float around town. Many will come to me directly. Oh, I'll invent, no doubt. Even now, I intermittently forget about Margaret's book. Failing her. Working title, Margaret Merrill, Exile at the Window. A short book, a tribute, really. Something I feel obliged to accomplish, since in the end, I fell down on my part of our rocky friendship. I'm bothered by that. Plagued may be an overstatement, but there it is. A nagging, unfinished feeling, like not making the doctor's appointment when you're so overdue for a mammogram that every time you undress, you're imagining your X-rayed breasts pocked with calcified white dings, like the surface of the moon. May she find space here to breathe again. I'll puzzle out my own story, mapping constellations. Wish I may, wish I might. The three American women arrived shortly before the first frost of October 2015. Their individual stories began in Once Upon a Time Land, but their story together began by chance, as most stories do. And what if I had not sat next to Colin Davidson on the Florence airport bus? As I learned, they met in late April in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, USA. When the bus arrived at the Florence train station 10 years ago, Colin helped me with my lumpy bag. A stranger comes to town. That story. We intersected. Millions of atoms swarmed and reformed in the air. I have an exaggerated sense of smell. Not always a bonus. As he put down my bag on the curb, over the diesel fumes, I caught his scent of lime water and sun-dried linen, a scent from some idyllic tropical island I was yet to visit. I wanted to bury my face against his shoulder. "You are here," I thought. He smiled, and I remembered a quote from somewhere. The poet with the big lips. We looked at each other, I think with surprise. I'm reserved. I would never do this. But out of nowhere, I asked, "I'm Kit Rain. Do you have time for a drink?" I draw a large X on the second page and write, "X influx." I have no idea why. All dark below. I latch the shutter. Benvenute. Welcome. Part 2. Orientation. Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You're late, Charlie, which is fine with me. I don't want to go anyway. Ingrid had a loose wire cutting into her jaw, and I had to run her by the orthodontist before school. Sorry. Those wires must have gone off track for half the kids in town. We were stuck for over an hour for a 5-minute fix. It's always crazy when Lara is away. We'll be there in plenty of time, Mom. It doesn't start till 11. Camille slipped on a light sweater, lime green. Not an easy color to wear. And with her pale skin and newly blonde-streaked hair, she thought she looked subaqueous, or possibly jaundiced, in the hall mirror. She felt a moment of shame. Is every late middle-aged woman in America blonde-streaked? And what is late middle-aged now? Surely she qualified as simply old. She saw Charlie over her shoulder looking at her with a frown, a worried look she'd first seen on him in kindergarten, when his sweet potato didn't sprout and everyone else's grew a dangling vine. "I think you'll love it," he said. Unconvincingly, she thought. "Where is Lara this time? Someplace exotic? Charlie's Danish wife works as an anonymous inspector of hotels and restaurants for an annual Scandinavian guidebook. She's traveling constantly, leaving Charlie to squeeze in his painting around hauling Ingrid here and there, and recently driving his mother to physical therapy, Fresh Market, and today out to see Cornwallis Meadows. Usually Camille would drive herself, but 3 weeks after the replacement of her right knee, he thought the least he could do was take her. You know, I'm not sure. Maybe Vancouver? It's Lara who's encouraging Camille to move to Cornwallis Meadows, an idyllic over-55 community. Since Charles Sr.'s death last year, Lara has been on the subject of the 5 bedrooms and the waste and how it must be lonely, not to mention the burden of mountains of stored stuff in the garage and attic. Charlie sees her point, but can't imagine his mom out of the sprawling clapboard house with the deck built around a live oak. How many birthdays have been celebrated under that canopy of branches? Camille has her long borders, yes, a responsibility, but she loves knocking about among the phlox and wormwood, adding a couple of 100 daffodils every fall and gathering joyful peonies in late spring. Charlie remembers his practice, how ants shook down from the white and pink peonies onto the black lacquered piano as he pounded out Old Man River and Clair de Lune. White ones had a rosy smear in the middle, and he thought his mother had kissed each one. Vancouver sounds super. A great dinner and a fancy hotel. I'll take it over this jaunt. Camille sent out only this quick jab. She'd agreed to visit Cornwallis Meadows. Her daughter-in-law, she knew, was not just trying to manipulate her. She was genuinely concerned about Camille starting to figure out what Lara called the next stage of her life. But Camille suspected, too, that she had her eye on the house Charlie grew up in, its spacious glass-walled living room overlooking Spit Creek, and the kitchen with miles of travertine counters. Who could blame her? Charlie's painting career might never move them out of flimsy Carlswood Valley starter homes. Lara actually dreaded the airports, room service, kitchen visits, the inspecting of shower doors, turndown service that knocked just as you were dressing for dinner, and even looking under the hotel beds. A glamorous job that isn't. Maybe Charlie was childish. He didn't want to think of the house gone. Strangers stuffing their golf clubs and Christmas decorations in the attic, where he still stores his old snorkeling gear, tennis rackets, college textbooks, and early paintings. His mother's paintings are up there, too, facing against the dormer. Lara had mentioned that maybe if his mother liked Cornwallis Meadows, they could move out of the brick ranch with 3 shoebox bedrooms and yellowed hardwood floors. Charlie didn't see how that would be possible, unless his mother continued the upkeep and steep taxes. He didn't know how much money his dad had left. He assumed plenty for the rest of his mom's life, and he hoped a nice windfall for him afterward. He knew about the enormous life insurance policy because his mother had given him a big birthday check. Mom, just give it a chance. Just a look. Be fair. You might really like old Cornwallis. All the art classes, you never should have stopped painting. You know everything about it. You've memorized every painting after 1500. And they say the restaurant is good. Grilled halibut. Pot roast, garlic chicken. I saw the menu online. Really great choices at lunch and every night. No dreary cooking for one. There would always be someone to do things with, you know. You and Dad were so together. And you'd have your own apartment and car.
I know, sweetie. I'll keep an open mind.
Really, my knee is going to be fine, and I... She waved her arm around the living room, including the brimming bookcases, the piano, the two blue velvet sofas, and the rug brought back from Turkey on one of their expeditions, as they always called their trips. You know, Charlie. Home. All this. She gestured again. For a long time. Charlie saw her perplexed look change to a frown. Mom, you do exactly what you want to do.
You will anyway.
Nice that he thinks so. Since the afternoon last spring when Charles came home from work, she has no idea what she wants to do.
I'm home,
he called from the front door. His last words.
I'm in the kitchen.
He tossed his briefcase on the floor by the hall table and ducked into the bathroom to freshen up. Rinsing lettuces at the sink, water running, she didn't hear the thud as he hit the floor, felled by a massive heart attack as swift as it was fatal. Cornwallis Meadows, formerly a vast dairy farm bordered, the sign said, by an Indian trading path, later a mule track, that the British general and his soldiers were reputed to have trod during the Revolutionary War. The community managed a Chapel Hill address, though it was, Charlie now realized, near Hillsboro, way the fuck out of town. His mother put it more succinctly when, after about 15 minutes of speeding out old Highway 86, she observed, "This place is in East Jesus." They both laughed, and Charlie buzzed open the sunroof and all the windows for the brown earth smell of plowed fields, the tender spring green auras around the trees, and the sluicing water in roadside ditches running from the April rains. Soon the honeysuckle would be rampant, sending out shoots of heavy perfume. A local restaurant makes honeysuckle sorbet every spring, and Charlie always takes his mother for dinner during that brief season. He relishes her responsiveness to simple treats, how she smiles with her whole face over a handful of grocery store tulips or a basket of plums from his yard. Then he gets to feel personally responsible for her pleasure. At the wide-open white Cornwallis Meadows gates, Charlie turned in behind three other cars winding up the drive to the columned antebellum house that now served as the dining room and presentation rooms for the complex. The house had belonged to the Dalton family for donkey's years, the family that a century ago funded half the university buildings in the area, as well as more recently the medical research center that still draws droves of people to retire nearby. Later Dalton generations raised Tennessee walking horses, made bad marriages, and lost much of the solid fortune the first Tanner Dalton made. Who remembered how by now? They'd died off, and the last of them, Tanner the Fourth, in his dotage, sold the land and the house, married his nurse, and moved to Sarasota. The notable house and serene acreage that extended to the Eno River was snapped up by a Charlotte developer backed by serious venture capitalists. Therefore, Cornwallis Meadows. White square outbuildings lie scattered behind the house, four discreet retail businesses. Camille already knew of the Locavore Cafe, a shop selling expensive table linens, candles and soaps, a hair salon, and Inc., a bookstore with the gravitas to attract top writers for events. The streets ranging on either side of the big house are lined with connected cottage-style condos, each with a small front garden and picket fence. In the distance looms a large, more institutional building, U-shaped, with one wing for assisted living studios, the other for terminal hospice care. She had seen Sea Meadows, as the residents call it, when she visited Karen, a teaching colleague who sought help for blurred vision, only to be told she had a dinosaur brain tumor and 2 months to live. She'd lingered quietly for 8 months, cared for gently by the hospice staff. After a visit with her toward the end, Camille stopped to pick up something to read at the bookstore and spotted on the used shelf, unopened, the books she'd bought for Karen. She bought again Guests on Earth, thinking, yes, aren't we? That's about right. Charlie stopped in front and hopped out to open her door. Camille placed her right foot, the bad side, on the gravel, then swung out her other leg and let Charlie hoist her up. Once standing, she was fine, but getting out of bed, a car, or a deep armchair sent hot nails of pain down her leg. Sometimes, in sympathy, the other leg hurt.
You look great, Mama. I like your hair like this.
Camille did look great. The extra 15 pounds she'd accepted as her lot melted away over the months, and her skinny tennis player body moved with its normal grace again. One of her friends said recently and crudely, "Grief agrees with you."
"Bye, sweetie. You don't need to come back. They run a shuttle to town. A little walk home would be all to the good."
A woman in red pants and a swirly red and turquoise sweater paused at the beginning of the brick walk up to the house. She stared at the rows of begonias, pink, white, bordering either side. As Camille passed, the woman said,
"I would have preferred groups of pink, groups of white, and not in regiment rows."
Camille smiled.
"I'm Susan Ware. Are you going to the freshman mixer in there?"
Her hand felt solid and dry. Camille's was the opposite. She liked Susan's wide-open gray eyes, darker than her spiky silver hair.
"Yes, I'm Camille Trowbridge. I hate straight rows of anything, too, especially tulips, because they're bad enough."
Susan laughed, startlingly loud.
"Yes, someone who agrees with me. They look 3D printed.
Can't you see this bed interspersed with clumps of dusty miller, parsley, and lavender campanula?
That would be very pretty.
Oh, well, at least the begonias will fill out and last into fall."
She followed Susan inside, where they were given name tags and introduced to the residential manager, Blair Griffin, a dead ringer for Hillary Clinton down to the neon blue pantsuit. She shook hands firmly and welcomed them.
"We know you'll love the lifestyle at Sea Meadows, ladies. Everyone does. You'll hear all about it.
Walk around the house, get acquainted, and have some coffee while we wait for late arrivals." Her assistant handed them brochures and pointed them toward the coffee and pastries.
"Don't you hate to be called ladies? Oh, there's Bitsy Sanford. Is she retired? I used to carpool with her 100 years ago."
Susan walked over to the wing chair where a big-boned woman in a striped blouse with a bow sat slumped over her coffee cup. Camille wandered to the dining room and surveyed the croissants and bear claws.
"Hey, good morning. Those are as delicious as they look. I'm Julia Hadley, but I shouldn't shake hands. My fingers are all buttery."
They were, and she hadn't noticed that her croissant had flaked over her navy suit jacket and onto the rug. Camille smiled and introduced herself, then reached for one of the croissants.
"If we move here, I suppose we can have these every morning. Do you think they'll deliver them to your door?"
"Doubtful. And if they did, we'd have to double up on those dawn exercise classes."
"I'm just checking out the place."
"Are you moving here?" Camille asked. Julia paused.
"I have no idea what I'm doing."
Then she shrugged. Camille thought,
"I don't either.
But I don't have to do anything. I won't do anything. Then Julia burst out, I really do have to make a change. She broke off and took a large last bite of the croissant. Other women and two men met over their china cups and talked in quiet voices. As though we are at a funeral, Camille thought. An image of her husband rose. His habit of running his fingers through the swatch of dark blonde hair cutting across his forehead. Charles, whose hands were sculpted from marble, whose earlobe she liked to bite. Charles, coming home, tossing his keys on the counter, shedding his jacket, heaving his bulging briefcase into the coat closet. Charles, his faint smell of rain and spicy cologne. No funeral, memorial in the garden. After he was fire. Totally. He was fire, and then consumed by fire. Wasn't there a gauge, like an oven thermometer? Or did she imagine that? Unimaginable, Charles, a resin urn of ashes, chunks of bone. All of him, whose shoulders shook when he laughed. She and Charlie never scattered him. He's still at home. A year, and she still disbelieves her life is taken from her. Her mainstay. You are with someone, you plus him. Suddenly, he is a minus sign. Disappeared. Not only him, but that third thing created, the marriage. Broken, as simply and loudly as a plate shattering on a tile floor. That greater-than-the-sum entity of plans, past, ambitions, sorrows, ecstasy, on and on. Everything we were. Dust unto dust. Elementary. But she can't grasp the fact. She rotated her foot to shake loose the pain stabbing her knee. Maybe that's why I lost my knee, she thought. One-legged me. Breathe in. Breathe in. Her attention swung back to the high-ceilinged dining room, with the large window onto a knot garden and a thin white wedge of the hospice unit. Is it just the formal decor, the Williamsburg style, that keeps everyone stilled? Corner cabinets filled with silver compotes and crystal water glasses, the worn thin oriental rug, and the needlepoint bottoms on repro Chippendale chairs. Were the patterns on the chair bottoms all local flora? Someone's wife put her eyes out over those. Ah, Camille decided, all this says old, enduring, family. And most everyone here is a woman alone. 17, we're all here, and I welcome you heartily to See Meadows. Folding chairs supplemented the armchairs and sofas in the great living room, where Blair Griffin stood in front of the fireplace looking down on those gathered this morning to hear about life at the Meadows, to take a little tour, have lunch, and to decide whether to purchase units. The lunch would be special, a frise salad and crab cakes, with a respectable Chardonnay and an almond tart for dessert. Some would buy today. It was in her court. She smiled at the faces looking up at her. All were white, except for an elegant woman in a purple sari shot with metallic thread, a Japanese woman with a walker, and an African-American man leaning on a cane topped with an ivory horse head. There's a chair, she said, motioning to him. One couple appeared to be just at the age 55 entry point. Everyone comfortable? Let's get started. If it's time to turn a page, we hope you will love what you see here today. Susan focused on the screen over the fireplace
as appealing photographs seamlessly replaced each other, Ken Burns style. Exercise class in an indoor pool, then flowered chaise longue around an outdoor pool.